Here we go. All right. Julie very kindly and in timely fashion gave us a distribution. This includes almost everything except a few late exercises that have come in and a couple of eco exams, I think. So you can tell exactly where you are just by reading the numbers on the bottom, right? Right. I actually did increase the font size, and then when it printed out, it brought them right back down. So that average is at 83. And we're not sure that's the average, since that distribution doesn't look like it would average out to 83, so we think it's higher than that. And Julie's going to check on that. It's probably recording some absent people, people who are no longer in the class, and recording them as zero, and that's lowering the whole average. It also may be dividing by a larger number than are actually in the class, so we'll clean that up and give you a cleaned up version on Wednesday. But the important thing for many of you, what you were concerned about, the numbers are real. And that really is 83. And that really is 100. And that really is 112. And that really is 90, right there. So I'm going to assume that probably the average is closer to 90. But if you're in the 80s, high 70s and 80s, you're clearly okay. You may not be where you want to be. If you're 90 and up, you're running AB in some form. If you have 112, you have an A probably so far, assuming you do the sixth assignment and do well on the exam. Okay, but that's what it looks like now. It's beginning to stretch out, so it's a little easier to see where I might divide it. But assignment six may change it considerably, and we'll know that by next week. Okay? Questions about that or any other housekeeping details? Okay. We have four classes, including this one, and then an exam sometime during exam week, Tuesday, during exam week. Would you like to have review sessions before that? You would like to have a review session on Friday, May 5th, perhaps, in the afternoon? There is some other exam on Friday afternoon. Okay. Would you like a review session on Monday? The 8th. Okay. In the morning? In the late afternoon? Late afternoon? Morning? There are a few early risers. You don't want one on Friday? How many of you would like one on Friday afternoon? Would you prefer Saturday? Sunday? Thursday evening. Late Thursday afternoon, 3 o'clock, 3:30, 4 o'clock. Okay. So we're not finding a mutual time. I can't do Thursday during the day because I have an all-day faculty meeting from 9 to 3, 8:30 to 3. See, it's not all fun and games when you grow up. And I can't do Friday morning. Why not? There's something on my calendar Friday morning. How many of you would like one Friday morning if my calendar cleared? You need one Friday anyway. If you have an exam Friday afternoon, right? Okay, I got it.
Duh.
Okay, so Monday late afternoon. Wednesday after class? Okay, I'll check my schedule and we'll see what else we can do. Okay. Any other housekeeping details? Nobody's going to ask what's on the final?
Everything.
You already know the answer. Joanna knows the answer. Okay. Everything, all the readings, all the concepts, interpretation, application. What day is the final? Tuesday? The 9th. So at 4? Mary Beth? I don't know. No. The question was, are there 50 multiple choice? I have no idea. No. Just when we run out of gas, I suppose. Multiple choice, short answer, a couple of short essay, some fun stuff, crossword puzzle. No, we won't do crossword puzzles. What? Word searches? Right. Okay. All right. Enough of that. Galinsky. We had been talking about the authority stage and the issues involved with deciding what kind of parents you're going to be and having to deal with saying no, teaching the child guidelines, figuring out how you're going to set limits for the child, and confronting power. And one of the issues, of course, is that many children, as they get into the two-year-old stage, begin to enter a wider world. So they're in childcare, they're in play groups, they're going out with you, and they're mobile, and they're vocal, and they can demonstrate that they are wonderfully socialized, intelligent, obedient, but not beaten down children. Or they can demonstrate that they're little hellions whose parents are totally incompetent and haven't set any limits for them at all or not doing their duty at all. So these are high stakes, how you decide what you're going to do in the authority stage. These are high stakes because as the child goes out and people are able to look at the child and the child's behavior is obviously the parent's responsibility if the child is being good and the parent's fault if the child is making a nuisance. Okay, so that's where we were. Now, one of the issues that Galinsky describes as complicating the matter of authority and setting limits and teaching children is that children come with different temperaments. Galinsky talks about that. Honig talks about that in her chapter on raising confident children. Temperament is an important concept, and what it represents is the conclusion from the data that children are wired differently biologically. They come at you with a physiology which varies from other children's physiology. And it's on the basis of that physiology that children bring in stimuli, they receive stimuli, they respond to it, they regulate their responses to it, and children differ in how responsive they are to different kinds of stimuli, how easily they adapt to them, how quickly and how precipitously and how thoughtfully they respond to situations that they are in. And Galinsky describes the 9 characteristics from the Chess, Thomas, and Birch research, the 9 characteristics of the activity of the child, including activity level, rhythmicity or regularity. You don't have to write these all down because they're in Galinsky. Approach or withdrawal, adaptability, the threshold of your responsiveness. If you've had human development or child development, this is old stuff for you, so it's just a review. Intensity of your reaction, how quickly do you respond and how intensely. The quality of your mood. Some people from infancy on appear to be pretty negative, and other people are generally quite positive and sunny. And it may not have anything to do with the day of the week that they're born on. Distractibility and attention span and persistence. How quickly do kids give up the struggle to convince you that they're right? Or do they persist at it until they wear you down? So in Galinsky's view and in Honig's view, it's important to understand what the child is bringing to the transaction with the parent. The child does not have control over his or her responses, but there is a style that the child brings to the transaction with the parents. And that style is in part based on the biology of the child. It's not something that the parent creates, except perhaps genetically, since temperament seems to have a reasonably strong genetic component. And if you have two parents who are both what we call difficult people with negative tone and intense reactions and resistance to change, two people of that sort are likely to have children of that sort. Two people who have easy temperaments, they're adaptable and generally positive. They're rhythmic, they're regular in their cycles. Two people of that sort are likely to have easy children. And as the label suggests, difficult children are harder to raise than easy children because the transactions that they create based on their temperaments are different. And a child who's going to give you an initial negative response to any change in the schedule and who's going to be high intensity in all of his or her responses so that that negative mood is expressed intensely and quickly and unpredictably, that child is going to create different transactions with the parent than the child who is regular and predictable and accepts change easily and responds to change. Okay, well, let's try this out. I'll reserve judgment for a little while. And see how it goes. Those children create a transaction that is much more flexible, much more positive, much easier for the parent than the other kind of child. And in the relational world, then, the joint activities that you're engaging in will differ depending on the temperament. The kind of reciprocity you can set up will differ depending on the child's temperament and the parent's temperament, since parents also have styles. They came into the world as babies with different biologies. And then on the basis of their experience in the world, they've moderated or intensified the particular characteristics that they brought in, and they bring those temperamental characteristics into their partnering relationships and into their parenting relationships. So you have what Chess, Thomas, and Birch call goodness or badness of fit. I mentioned the Galinsky, but you also have the article or the chapter from Chess and Thomas's book, Your Child is a Person. You have the particular chapter on goodness of fit, which describes again the temperament types and then the importance of the fit between what the child is putting into the transaction and what the parent is expecting and encouraging as you create the transaction. So goodness of fit refers to the transaction between parent and child and the transaction between the child's temperament and what the parents are expecting. A goodness of fit doesn't mean that the child and the parent have the same temperament. If both parents and the child are easy and adaptable and generally positive, there's likely to be a pretty good fit. But if both parents and the child have very difficult, negative, reactive temperaments, that's a bad fit. That's a fit that's going to lead to difficulty in the transaction, conflict in the transaction, and negative affect in the interactions, in the relationship between the parents and the child. When you put the relations and the activity and the transactions that are going on in those relationships together, and you have temperament helping to shape the pattern of the microsystem in the household. So if you have easy children who are quite adaptable and flexible and easy in their response to change, so you can change the schedule on them and say, well, we're going to leave at in 20 minutes instead of 2 hours, so you're going to have to pick up what you've been playing with now, and we're not going to have time to go by grandma's, which you were really looking forward to. I know, and I'm sorry about that. Then I've just given you three changes. You've got to pick up what you were playing with an hour and a half before you thought you had to. We're going to leave, so anything else you had planned is gone, and we're not going to grandma's house because we don't have time for that. So I'm disappointing you. You can imagine the responses to the change in the schedule that the parent has just presented to the child. A child who has an easy temperament is going to say, wow, why? Okay, gosh. So you do it and you get your stuff and you get ready to go. And then you can have a conversation with the parent about when can you go to grandma's house and can you play with this stuff later. But if you have a negative temperament, you've got a kid who's saying, no, we can't do that. You said we were going at 3. I've got this stuff out. I'm going to put this away. I'm not done with it yet. I got an hour and a half to go. What do you mean we're not going to grandma's house? Bleh! I hate you. So you have that transaction that's being set up that is going to create negative affect. One parent is saying, okay, good. You know, I've got a cooperative kid. We can get this together. Now we can go. Thank you very much. And you get lots of positive affect in the transaction. The other parent is saying, I'm going to kill you. Or how did I, you're your father's child. Or the devil has possessed you or something. If the affect is negative and you can't have a positive conversation with the child about how cooperative the child is when the child is being uncooperative. You can work at it to suggest that if the child is cooperative, you'll appreciate it. You can suggest how the child might be cooperative. It would help me a great deal if you pick up your toys and put these away. And yes, we can play with those later. We'll give you enough information so that you know you're not losing everything you hold dear. But if the child is still saying no, then you have a transaction going on that is going to reduce the reciprocity, or you can increase the reciprocity by screaming back at the child, "I know you hate me and I hate you too, and I wish I didn't have to take you anywhere. In fact, maybe I'll leave you home. Maybe I'll just tie you up in the basement with a crust of bread and a bowl of water, like the dog." Well, anyway, that's a parent with a really negative, nasty temperament who's thinking of all kinds of dire things because the parent has difficulty with confrontation of a negative sort, and that's reflecting the parent's negative temperament, the difficult temperament. Okay? So you can see, I think, fairly easily, some of you probably have experience with microsystems that are driven by one or two people with difficult temperaments, reactive, negative characteristics. And hopefully more of you have experience of being in households that run smoothly because everybody's adaptable and flexible and optimistic and not terribly intense when they get disappointed. Okay. So the whole microsystem of the family is in part shaped. And parents have expectations, as we said. They have images about what the child is going to be like. The Gerber baby on the box has an easy temperament. You can just see it in the kid. Of course, it's a computer-generated image, so it's not real baby. If you took a really difficult temperament child at 6 or 8 months, it would be more likely to have a scowl, a frown, a dubious, "I don't believe you" look, or "I don't like what's about to happen, and this cereal that came out of this box that has my picture on it is going to gag me, and I hate it, and I'm never going to eat it again, and I'm going to spray it all over." That household doesn't run as smoothly. Okay. Parents have the expectation they have to accommodate the baby that they get. And part of that accommodation is figuring out what the temperament is. And Chess and Thomas's argument is that that's the parent's responsibility to figure out what the temperament is and help the child deal with it and adjust the expectations so that you're accommodating what you got instead of what you expected. Because the child is trying to set up a transaction that works too. So the child is trying to figure out what the parent's characteristics are, what the parent's temperament might be. It doesn't have the vocabulary to do that, and it will do what works. And if pushing your buttons gets the child what it wants, it will push your buttons. The child would like a microsystem that runs smoothly, but to the child, that smooth-running microsystem may be defined differently than the parent's smooth-running microsystem is defined. And you may not like it if the child is adapting to what it perceives as your difficult temperament. So Chess and Thomas argue that the parent has the responsibility. Honig, in her article on raising responsible, competent children, says, again, that it's the parent's responsibility to figure out what the child's temperament is, to create a good fit, to engage in activities that will help the child regulate itself more effectively, regulate its emotional reactions, and eventually, particularly if it has a negative, difficult temperament, to learn to express that in ways that are less destructive to the relationships and to the microsystem. But in both cases, in both articles, it's the parent's responsibility to figure that out. Parents also have expectations about gender. And, oh, before I jump to sex, this is a quote from the chapter that you have. I just wanted to comment on it. that goodness of fit exists when the demands and expectations of the parents and other people important to the child's life are compatible with the child's temperament, abilities, and other characteristics. So it's not just temperament, but your abilities. So that you're expecting behavior that is within the child's capabilities and stretching those, but not constantly frustrating the child by expecting behavior that the child is incapable of. With such a fit, a good fit, healthy development for the child can be expected. Poorness of fit, on the other hand, exists when demands and expectations are excessive and not compatible with the child's temperament, abilities, and other characteristics. With such a fit, a poor one, the child is likely to experience excessive stress and healthy development is jeopardized. And it's jeopardized because the fit, the appropriateness of the expectations, determines whether or not the relations with the parent can be positive, in affect, reciprocal, increasingly complex joint activities because the parent likes to be with the child and vice versa. Or whether they're going to be, whether you're going to experience a relationship in which the parent and the child are in a power struggle when reciprocity means they fight about the same things and they don't engage in appropriate activities with positive affect because they're fighting with each other. Okay? Questions about temperament before I run on to the other complication? You've all figured out what you were, what you are. Some of you know you're difficult. Some of you know you're easy. Some of you know you're slow to warm up. Then you figure out what your parents are. You figure out whether the fit is good or poor. And the next complication is gender. People get boys or girls, usually. One or the other, both, two of each, whatever, but children come with a gender. And there are very small differences between boys and girls at birth, and those differences then may become more and more distinct, in part based on kids' personalities, kinds of experiences they have, what they enjoy doing, but also based on what kinds of expectations parents and later peers place on them. Parents have images about what they're going to get and what a girl is going to be like and what a boy is going to be like. And if there's a good fit between those expectations that they have and the child that they get, again, the activities may be shaped in a particular way and the relationship will be shaped positively or negatively depending on how well the child is meeting the parent's expectations. Parents also come gendered. Fathers are typically male, mothers are typically female, and they are playing gender in their partnership with each other. And they're playing gender in their parenting. The fathers and mothers tend to treat children differently, and fathers and mothers tend to treat boys and girls differently. Even those of us who think we're not being sexist in our child rearing tend to treat boys and girls differently. It takes a great deal of awareness and commitment to not do that. We all grow up in a gendered world. So one of the pieces of development is happening in the microsystem as activities get divided by gender. These are boys' activities, these are girls. Girls can do this, boys can do this. girls express their emotions this way, boys don't, they express it a different way. The activities, the expression, the skills, the interests, the joint activities that kids engage in with each parent may be very different, or they may not be differentiated at all. In some families, everybody treats everybody else with respect and openness, and there may not be much gender play in the microsystem. That's one of the areas of great diversity across households. Some people play gender all the time, and fathers and mothers in some families are very different, and they treat boys and girls very differently. And they sometimes will make it very clear that they wish they had had the other sex, the one you're not. Well, if I'd had a couple of sons, then I wouldn't have to put up with all this estrogen in the family and all these things that I don't like and can't understand and can't deal with. Those comments from parents, their attitude, their valuation of boys and girls and husbands and wives, each other in the household, create the affect, reciprocity within the microsystem, within the relationships in the microsystem. And every household, every family creates a more or less gendered context for development, in which kids are learning that they either fit their parents' expectations as a boy or as a girl, or they don't, or they want to be just like their mother, or they don't, based on how they see themselves as male or female, and how they see male and femaleness being played out within the family context. There are potential conflicts across generations as grandparents have perhaps a more traditional view of what boys and girls ought to do than their children do. And as boys and girls are growing up, they may be even more non-traditional than their own parents. So you may have generations disagreeing with each other about what boys and girls are supposed to do, how to play male, how to play female. You have problems potentially between siblings of different sexes because the expectations for them may be different. And parents may allow boys in a family to do things that they don't allow girls to do. As an example, as kids go into adolescence, it's very typical that parents, both male and female parents, fathers and mothers, become more restrictive of girls' behaviors than of boys. Boys are allowed more latitude. We have to protect the girls from whatever might happen to them. We have to make sure they maintain their virginal status so we can get a higher bride price for them, so they're more, so they don't raise questions that we can't answer. So we protect them. And adolescent girls are likely to resent that, especially if they see brothers in the same family being allowed more privilege, more freedom, less supervision. Academic expectations may be higher for one sex than the other. The parents may set up competitions between them. There are many different ways, and I don't have to recite all these for you. You know that parental expectations and values on different behaviors, what they think is appropriate for each sex, may differ widely. So the activities that they engage in with kids may be different. Fathers may engage in many more activities with sons than they do with daughters. Mothers may engage in more with daughters. And all of those create the context for creating the relationships and shaping the behavior of children growing up. And then on top of that, fathers and mothers don't always agree. They often disagree on what is appropriate for males and females. Okay. So conflict in the parental dyad may be based on their disagreement about what is appropriate for daughters, what is appropriate for sons. And they may discipline differently. They may allow greater expression of one sex compared to the other. They may approve of particular behaviors for one sex rather than the other. And in their difference, they create conflict that affects the operation of the microsystem. So, parenting's a piece of cake, right? It's just real easy to figure out how to do it exactly right. Your parents did it, and you've written rules on how to do it, so you're in good shape now. And we're going to mail them to you in about 5 years. As soon as we detect a pregnancy, we're going to, or an adoption or foster care, we're going to send them to you and say, okay, here's what you said you were going to do. Questions about gender and its involvement in the context. We've talked the authority stage to death and now its complications, and we're going to leave the temperament and gender and other personality characteristics and interests and IQs and all that of the children as a foundation, and then we're going to look at the other three stages in Galinsky's presentation. And the next one is called the interpretive stage. And this is how she describes the elementary school years. She says, what's really challenging parents at this point, what their major task consists of, is to interpret the world to their children. This is about cognitive and interpersonal and socio-emotional development. Interpret yourself to your children. Interpreting your children to themselves. Interpreting the whole world to them. Answering their endless questions. Providing them access to the skills and information they need, and helping them form values. And Galinsky says, parents find that their children's questions cause them to re-examine and then test their own implicit theories about the way things work. Why is the sky blue, Daddy? Why can't I do this or that? Why can't little boys do this? All of the questions that children ask challenge parents to come up with an interpretation, to know why something is, to explain it, and to find the language to explain it to your children at a level that they can understand. That process of trying to answer a kid's questions changes parents. So if kids didn't ask questions and didn't need to have things explained to them, then parents could go on as they were. But because the child's mind is developing and the child is curious and wants the explanations for things, then parents have to examine their understanding. And often what we run into as parents is that we may not understand something, even if we studied it in school or think we understand it or have an intuitive understanding of it, it may be difficult for us to explain it. Why can't I take the candy bar from the store without paying for it? When you discover that the six-year-old has a candy bar in her hand in the parking lot that didn't get paid for, because the kid put it in her pocket because she wanted it and because she knew you wouldn't let her have it. And so she just swiped it. It's called shoplifting. So there you are in the parking lot with a seven-year-old who wants to know why not. You get to explain morality to a seven-year-old. You get to explain the web of trust, the threat of the police, whatever it is that you understand as the basis for not shoplifting. What is the basis for your morality? You get to explain that as a parent. And what often happens to us is that we don't remember. We've never actually tried to explain it to somebody. Have you tried to explain to somebody why you shouldn't take things that don't belong to you? It's an interesting challenge to state it in a way that a 7-year-old is going to understand, or an 8-year-old. And then to have the continued discussion when the child disagrees with you. And you're thrown back on what is your authority. You go back to the previous stage. It's easy to explain it if it's because I said so. But if you, in fact, are really going to be an authority on things, then you have to actually explain it in a way that the child can understand. Question? And?
Well, I just never did that. My kid, she was pretty young.
Yeah.
But kind of got one whole share thing.
Right, including the person who owns it. Yeah. Yes, they are supposed to share, but they're supposed to ask you if you would like to share it with them. And things that are for sale aren't likely to be shared. How many of you did get away with shoplifting? Your parents knew you did it? And they didn't respond to it. Good. Not many of you. Well, a few of us. Yeah. Okay. The interpretive stage forces parents to figure out what to do when their kids have done something wrong. It means that you have to engage in a joint activity of, in the case of shoplifting, taking the kid back to the store at 4 years old or 5 years old or 10 years old or 14 years old and requiring the child to return the item or pay for it if it's already been eaten and apologize. That's your responsibility as a parent in the view of some of us, especially those of us who didn't do it and wish that we had when our kids shoplifted. I've talked to a couple of parents who said probably the worst thing they ever did that got their parenting off track was that they didn't respond when their kids did things wrong. They didn't respond firmly and instantly and decisively to enforce the rules and insist that the child learn the rules, learn to apologize and not do it again. And when you don't do that, the message you give the kid is, it's okay. Uh-huh. And then it goes from the candy bar, and this is not an exaggeration, it goes from the candy bar to books, CDs, bigger things, somebody else's bicycle, cars, money, lots of money, beer and wine, and all the other things that kids are likely to wish they had. And if their parents don't respond at the beginning, the parents are establishing a world view for the child that says, as long as you don't get caught, it's okay. If you get caught, I don't know you. So the kid figures out how not to get caught. That's not much of a challenge in most cases. You can make it worse as a parent by supporting the child. Oh, you stole some. Well, it's not your fault you stole it. The shopkeeper shouldn't have it near the exit. Or the people who had the CDs are charging too much. And you're creating a worldview that says not only is it okay if you don't get caught, but it's probably your responsibility as a person to steal. And if you look at books like The Criminal Mind, people who create a pathway, a trajectory developmentally of crime, have created an understanding of the world which says you're entitled to whatever you want and everybody else is a sucker and it's their fault if they get ripped off, not yours. So the parent is starting off very, very early, establishing an interpretation, creating an interpretation, an understanding of the world in the child's mind, a valid and differentiated view of the world that you live in, and that valid and differentiated view is going to make the kid an acceptable human being in the long run, or a problem for somebody else. Okay, the morality stuff is fairly easy. How do you interpret the workings of the social world, the universe? How do you interpret friendship, bullying, relationships with teachers, mathematics, correct grammar, so that by the time people get to college, they understand that... No, I'm not going to go there. Okay. So that you all know Larry's pet peeves and never violate them, right? Because you know how language works. And your parents have used it appropriately and interpreted for you the necessity of learning to read and speak grammatically correctly. Okay. The entire universe is potentially fodder for the parent to interpret to the child. Why do you put gasoline in the car? Why do horses have shoes? Why do I have to go to school? Why do I have to wear a seatbelt? Why do I have to sit in a booster seat? On and on and on and on. Why do I have to go to church? Why do you go to church? Why don't you love mommy anymore? Why don't you live together? Other kids have parents who live in the same household. Why don't I? Will I get divorced when I grow up? Why are those two men raising children? What's a civil union? Your opportunities to explain everything that goes on are infinite with kids. You're also interpreting your child to the world. You go to parent-child conferences. You help the teacher understand what your child is interested in, how your child likes to learn. How well can you do that? How well can you interpret to the parent, to the teacher, what it is that your child brings to the classroom? So you're called on by the child's involvement in those other settings to interpret your child in those other settings. That's part of the function of the parent. Parents who do that and do that reasonably well have children who are more likely to succeed, to be successful in those settings. If your parents can't interpret you in those settings or don't even try because they don't go into them, you're missing those links in the child's mesosystem that might provide support and inter-setting communication. So interpretation includes going out to the other settings in the child's mesosystem, making them part of your mesosystem, and being a supportive link. Being able to go talk to the teachers or the coaches or the ballet teacher or whoever it is and interpret that situation to your child so your child is understanding it. That's the parent's responsibility in helping the child understand the mesosystem that the child is engaged in. And the better parents can do that, the more intersetting knowledge the child has, the more successful the child is going to be in those settings. How involved are you going to be as a parent? Is everything going to be a closed activity network so that you're engaged in most activities with the child? Are you going to step back and let the child do things that he or she might be interested in that you don't have interest in? How do you support those activities? Do you support those activities? How do you interpret your lack of interest in something? How do you interpret the fact that you don't want the child to play hockey? Because hockey is a sport that takes care of teeth, and because if you live in Underhill, the child will practice in Essex at 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's no way that's going to happen. Period. Or downhill skiing. I'm sorry. Can't afford lift tickets, can't afford equipment, it's not going to happen, but I will very happily go cross-country skiing with you. Why will Daddy not do downhill skiing? Because Daddy doesn't like speed, heights, or danger. And he's a klutz, and he's perfectly fine on level ground, but he's not going downhill, and therefore neither are you. And did Daddy get to say, "Told you so"? See, I was right. Yes, because favorite daughter in her first year of downhill skiing after high school, before college, decided to go with the other instructors. She was an instructor her first year of preschoolers. She went with the other instructors down Tuckerman Ravine. How many of you have been down Tuckerman Ravine? On the ice. All the way? Standing up at the bottom? Yeah, he did. Okay. So, you know, Gwen drove herself to the doctor and had her shoulder put back in place. Oh, anticipating the teenage years. As you're going through the elementary school years, you're beginning to anticipate what's going to happen in the next stage. If you're smart, you're going to be anticipating that. I think I've already told, maybe it was this class, one of the frustrations in my life is that I listen to parents anticipate the teenage years in front of their children by saying how much they're afraid of it. They really dread their kids going through puberty because they know that their kids will start to hate them and they'll become obnoxious. And they're saying this to 10-year-old kids who haven't yet started puberty, but they're saying it in front of them, so the kids are getting a view of what adolescence is going to be about. I usually clap my hand over the parent's mouth and say, "Hush, do your fear in silence. Don't tell your kids what your worst fears are about their behavior in adolescence. Instead, start interpreting the things that they're going to need to know about." You start talking about drugs and alcohol and smoking when kids are 3 in anticipation that by the time they're pubescent, their world will expose them to it. And you want to make sure that your interpretations have created a foundation that helps the child resist experimenting with the drugs and alcohol and other illegal substances and smoking that are going to get them addicted or get them into trouble. You anticipate the teenage years by anticipating sex. Kids go through puberty. Some of them get curious. Some of them start relating to each other. They get curiouser and curiouser. If you don't interpret to them, explain to them the nature of relationships as they're going through elementary school, if they don't know where babies come from and how to keep them there, if you aren't giving them the information and forming viewpoints that will allow them to go into adolescence ready to face the temptations that are going to, and the pressures that are going to be there, then you're not helping the child move into that next step. And in that next stage, kids are likely to create for you bigger questions and bigger problems. So, interpretation is about explaining yourself, your views, your understanding to your child, to other people, explaining the child to herself, helping to develop a self-concept, explaining the child to other people in the mesosystem, and interpreting the big world and the future world to the child so that you've established yourself as a person who does understand and does have values that the child can respect and hopefully at least consider sharing as she gets older. Questions about that stage or anything that Galinsky said? One of the transitions at the early part of the interpretive stage is going to school. And that exposes children to a bigger world and other adults whose interpretations of the world may be different. So as the child goes into those mesosystem settings that parents may not be in charge of, such as school, you set up the possibility of conflict between settings, different viewpoints and different interpretations. And part of what the parent is going to do is interpret those differences. The child is going to be exposed to different value systems, different macro systems. And every time the child hits one of those different settings or different ways of interpreting the world, that potentially will come back home to be interpreted. Or, if you're failing utterly at the interpretive stage, by the time the child is 6 or 7, the kid knows there's no point asking you a question. The answer won't make any sense. You'll reject the question as stupid. You don't know the answer, and the kid will know that. So none of those differences get brought home because there's no point. So the parent's failing interpretation 101, and the child is discovering that. And that's reducing the joint activities with the parent. It's reducing the reciprocity. And it's making other people more important to the child than the parent. And other people's views more important than the parent. What the child is going to be looking for, if the parent is unable to interpret, is people who can interpret. So they're going to look for adults who know things. If they can't find them, they're going to look for peers who know things. And what they're likely to find is peers who are not as knowledgeable as they think they are. And you get interpretations of love and life and relationships and drugs and alcohol and careers and school and society that come from people who aren't as knowledgeable potentially as a parent would be. So it's important, in Galinsky's view, that during the interpretive stage, kids are exposed not just to parents who have the ability and the knowledge to interpret and clarity about the world and about themselves in it, but other people as well. Teachers, Girl Scout leaders, Boy Scout leaders, Campfire Girl leaders, boys and girl camp instructors, and all of those other people who are in a position to interpret and who have favored positions to interpret because of what we assume is their expertise. And parents also need to be screening those people that their kids are going to be relying on for additional and alternative interpretations. It's helpful, as Galinsky said, to provide the tools and access to interpretations. So what you do with reference books in the home, for example, is important. Some kids know more than their parents or can ask many questions that their parents can't answer. But one of the issues for parents is, how do you respond to those? Do you love the question? Admit that you don't have a clue. Let's look it up. We look it up in the dictionary, we look it up in the encyclopedia, we look it up in the reference works, we look it up online, we go to the library together to look it up, we make a joint activity of learning the things that we don't understand. Kids can push parents' learning in that way, if parents are willing to engage in that joint activity and make developing an interpretation a joint activity in which there is mutuality or reciprocity. And that can become fun. That creates the tools and access to the information for kids that they will use then the rest of their lives, if you do it. Then along comes puberty and the interdependent stage. What does she mean by interdependent stage? What's going on in this particular stage? Why is it interdependent? Puberty is a set of changes, a huge set of changes, physically, intellectually, and interpersonally, that require the parents to engage in a transaction that changes very quickly. As kids go through puberty, their size changes, their physiology changes, their hormones change, their emotions change, their intellects change. And the result of puberty, very simply, is that adolescents, as they become, are their parents' equals. Adolescents become as big as or bigger and stronger than their parents, and they become as smart as or smarter than their parents in terms of the ability to take in new information, process it, ask questions. They use the same logic. They don't have the same experience that their parents have, but they do use the same logic. And that means they can engage in argument that truly is between equals and love to do that. It's important how kids go through puberty and when they go through puberty. We all have images of what it's going to be like. So we assume that it'll happen about the time kids become teenagers. We use that word teenager synonymously with adolescent. And it's a little bit of a surprise when your 9-year-old begins to go through puberty. You're not ready for it. Every once in a while I do one of those wonderful I'm a developmental psychologist things that impresses people. We had a neighbor in Pittsburgh who actually needed some family therapy, and so I ended up giving it to her. It took about 15 minutes to cure the family. The problem in the family was that they had a 10-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old daughter and a 1-year-old daughter. And the 1-year-old daughter had come along. In fact, the timing was perfect. After the two older daughters had gotten old enough, mom and dad decided that was it. So they sold all their baby furniture and stuff. And as it was going away on somebody's pickup truck, mom didn't know it, but she was pregnant again. The timing was absolutely wonderful. So they had this new baby, which the older daughters thought was wonderful. Parents weren't so sure. And as luck would have it, they got one of Chess and Thomas's really obnoxious, difficult babies. Cute, never stopped fussing, hated everything, wouldn't eat, slept irregularly. By the time I met her, when she was just under one, we moved into the house next door. And this kid was just obnoxious. She was just unpleasant. She was unhappy. She was uncomfortable. She was, yeah. And mom's complaint was she had these two wonderful daughters and their lives were being ruined by their baby sister who was so obnoxious. So mom and dad were blaming each other for having had this accident and ruining not only their own lives, but their older daughter's lives. That's the point at which we moved in next door. And that was their interpretation of their family to us was that. They had ruined their lives by having this kid who was just inconsolable and totally unreasonable. So, as evidence of how much the older daughters... Well, I watched them. The older daughters seemed to be sort of annoyed by their younger sister, but it certainly wasn't ruining their lives. But so I asked the mom, what evidence do you have it's ruining her life? And she said, well, she's become moody. She blows up at the smallest thing. And she gets really annoyed with me and her little sister, and that was evidence that obviously those things were being caused by the baby. But I like to watch kids, and what I saw was a kid who was rapidly entering puberty. I saw a kid with really, really long legs and big hands and feet and facial changes. So I saw a 10-year-old who was pubescent. And so I'm hearing, hypothalamus, adrenal cortex, gonads, all those things that are going to happen at puberty. So I suggested that it might not be the baby's fault, and there really wasn't any evidence that the younger sister was having her life ruined. There was nothing going on in her life. But it was the 10-year-old who was clearly ruined. So I told Mom that I thought maybe there was an alternative hypothesis that maybe she was just a teenager. She was pubescent. And the mother looked, no, it can't be. She's only 10. I said, well, looks will deceive, but the long bone growth and the facial growth and the hands and feet, I suspect that if you looked closely, you'd probably see breast buds and pubic hair. And this could not be. So the next evening, I came home from work, Mom came over. You were right. Yeah, breast buds, pubic hair, pubescent. 10-year-old, Mom wasn't ready for this. The image is kids don't become pubescent at 10 or 9 or 8. The reality is they do. And when they do, parents have to adjust their images and figure out what they're going to do now with a teenager who's not yet teenage. How are you going to do that? You have images of timing, and you have images that your child is just going to get bigger and not change. And the reality is that all of us change as we go through puberty. We change in what we do, how we do it, and how we feel about it, and how we think about it. So the transactions change with the parents, and as kids become adolescent, there's a lot of negotiation. Negotiation toward more equal power, greater reciprocity, a challenge to the affect, kids question what's going on, what their parents believe, what their parents say, what their parents do. They're arguing for the sake of argument. Argument never creates positive affect. So parents are having to face a child who is now not only asking questions they have an even harder time answering, but a child who is now questioning the answers and developing his or her own answers and own interpretations and presenting them as equally valid. And the parent is then having to discuss them on a more equal and more respectful level. How you demonstrate affect changes. Who you demonstrate affection toward changes. You're creating a new authority challenge as the kid's world opens up even wider. Adolescents are able to take off. They get their driver's license. They go on long sleepovers. They go out with peers. Peers who clearly have interests in them that the parents would rather not think about. You don't want to think about that, but you have to. Kids are engaging in activities that parents understand even less well, problems that parents had and remember and don't want to remember have to be interpreted. So Galinsky is describing this as the interdependent stage because the equality, the involvement in activities for the child and the parent are much greater. The reciprocity of their interests is much greater. And the creation of problems that parents can't interpret, don't know how to deal with, is much more likely. And we'll pick up from there and finish that and look at the launching stage on Wednesday.